Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hi everyone, it's Nicola here, and I'm known as the techie one. And we've had a few sound challenges on this episode and the next following couple of episodes, but we're working hard to fix it. And of course, the content is solid and the interview rocks. So do bear with us and we'll get the sound problems fixed as quickly as possible. Hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment of this episode and you'll stick with us.
Hello and welcome to episode 60 of Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Steph and with me in the studio are the whole gang. Teresa, Linda, Heather, Nicola and Pat.
Yes.
This week on Write Club, we're talking about writing competitions and sharing some insider secrets on ways to improve your chances of winning. We're going to hear from Nicola's work in progress and then we'll be offering her feedback and critique just the way we do in our Write Club meetings. Teresa is going to talk about her word of the week. And at the end of the show, Linda and Eve White of the Eve White Literary Agency are going to share what's on their bedside tables. But before all that, Pat is going to ask us to
name the novel.
This book won the Whitbread Award for a first novel in 1985. It's semi-autobiographical and it's based on the author's life growing up in Lancashire. In England, beginning when she's 7 years old and living with her adoptive parents.
I think I know it.
Yeah.
It's in Lancashire, I won't
know. I know. I think it's an easy one for Teresa.
Yeah.
Well she's from
maybe,
Lancashire.
Maybe, yeah. We'll see.
Okay.
7 years old in Lancashire, 1985.
Adoptive parents. Mm-hmm. Moving on. The television adaptation of the book was made and aired by the BBC in 1990. It starred Charlotte Coleman and Geraldine McEwan, and at the time, it was really quite controversial.
Yeah, I'm sticking with my first guess.
I'm putting my pen down.
that's very definitive. That's not like you, Nicola.
I'm thinking...
Are you indeed?
Really?
I couldn't hear you.
That's because I didn't want, I wanted to whisper it to Teresa if there was a look of recognition in her eyes and I didn't want you to hear.
Okay, and the final clue. The book explores the conflict between Christian fundamentalism and same-sex relationships author falls for one of her female converts.
Yes, it is.
Oranges are not the only fruit.
By Jeanette Winterson.
Yes,
we said in harmony.
And you got that right at the very beginning.
Yeah, then you said Lancashire and growing up, and the period was right. You know.
Yeah, I got it on the second clue. Yeah. Really, yeah.
I must admit, when I was sort of preparing this and looking at the various reviews and so on, comments about the novel, I thought, I don't remember that bit. There was quite a lot about the way that the Bible sort of underpins the structure,
yes,
and the stuff about fairy tale and myth being subverted throughout.
It's a long time since I read I can't remember that. And I didn't read quite a few other Jeanette Winterson's. Obviously, that was her first big breakthrough.
Yeah.
But she's still writing. I think she's got something coming out this year, hasn't she?
Yeah.
And it's still being televised very often.
Yeah, last year, I think, wasn't it? Yeah. But I remember, I think that's one of the relatively few, I think, where I enjoyed the television. Maybe because I saw it first before I read the book. But I really enjoyed the television version. And then not the novel quite so much.
Right. Well, I read the book and then saw the TV. But I think at the time I thought it was well done, but it's so long ago.
Charlotte Coleman was apparently in Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yeah. Doesn't she open it?
Yes.
With the swearing.
Yes, she does.
The one the alarm goes.
She's the bridesmaid who arrives with her dress undone.
Is she? Yes. And has she now died?
Yes.
She's this kind of like.
Yes.
Is
she was asthmatic.
I didn't recognise the name.
Right.
How sad.
Yes, very sad.
Well, thanks, Pat. because that's brilliant. Now, over to Nicola, what have you got for us this week?
Well, I've had quite a few comments that the opening chapter stroke prologue of my book is not adding anything to it. So I've been experimenting with, well, I've been thinking about different ideas for opening it. I read one of my favourite books over Christmas, which I'm going to talk about in Bedside Table at some point, and they started with a memoir. And I thought, oh, okay, that might work. So here we go. We're going to try it out. I'm writing this introduction to my memoirs on the eve of my next and hopefully my last mission. And as I've never written a memoir before, much less the introduction to one, I hope you'll bear with me. I might need to go around the houses a bit to work up to the point. The fire crackles playfully, fresh logs adding to the fun. My wing-back chair is old and battered and comfortable and shaped perfectly to my ancient derriere. Outside the lamplight, shadows loom from the corners of my room like memories looking over my shoulders to make sure I get their part of the story right. My feet are cosy warm in their velvet slippers with their natty little golden crowns embroidered on the front. They match my warm dressing gown with a tartan collar, and I get a little frisson of pleasure every time I slip this ensemble on, as it makes me feel like a proper writer. My belly's full of my favourite supper, and my stomach is warm from the fine malt whiskey I'm sipping between thoughts. All the correct elements are in place to make writing easy, but somehow it never is. It was never my intent to write a memoir, but around a year ago, her upstairs insisted. As she has access to wisdom I can only aspire to, I agreed. And after a healthy period of procrastination, which I'm told is very common and quite normal, I finally exasperated myself enough and began to write. Now, deadline looming, transportation for the mission arranged, the only part of these memoirs left to complete is to write this, the introduction. I like to call them missions as it makes them sound more fun than the reality, which involves an awful lot of hanging about in dark, wet corners trying to project my inner thoughts in an attempt to influence mostly unformed brains of all kinds to do my bidding. There are aliens and robots and monsters and humans, and sometimes you just can't tell them apart. There's good and evil and so-called extenuating circumstance and downright obfuscation. This is the story of a heartbroken girl called Brienne. It's also the story of an ancient evil. It's the story of a young old soul who has enormous potential, who aspires to be great, who is always striving to be better, but who is all too fallible. There's even a silent watcher. And in case you haven't guessed yet, that's me.
Well, I thought it was a nice sort of teasing opening. And the descriptive bit from The Fire Crackles Playfully in the next couple of paragraphs is lovely. It's delightful.
Setting, yeah.
And I know one of the things you were concerned about is it twee? I thought it's a little bit twee, but as long as you kind of quickly undermine that, I think it's fine, you know, playing between those two things, setting it up and knocking it down.
Well, I actually did think as soon as I'd written it, I could lose that whole first paragraph because that's adding nothing to it. So.
With the I am writing the introduction,
unnecessary as I go on.
Well, one of the things that I thought was there's the voice of the silent watcher that you're trying to establish, but sometimes the voice of Nicola is there, especially about, you know, I've got to write something now. I'm not really in the right frame of mind. I did. There was a little inconsistency in the voice there, a little bit of Nicola coming into it. Okay. So.
Well, I don't know exactly what twee means, but I think it means what I thought. And so, I mean, it's that I felt a lot of the beginning and a lot of the description was really not necessary and was a bit time bigger. Yeah. And I thought it would be so much better if you started, somewhere else over here, like a tale with many twists and turns and spinning. But I felt that there was just too much of this going through the description of where you are and how you're feeling, et cetera. And although the description is written beautifully, I don't think it helps you.
I found that
it was just too much. Without getting into the story.
Well, I'll tell you what. Sorry to interrupt you, Linda. Where you say this is the story of a heartbroken girl called Brienne, it's also the story of an ancient evil. It's the story of a young old soul who has enormous potential, who's always striving to be better, but who is all too fallible. Wouldn't that be good?
Lose all of it.
No. I'm saying
Okay. I would have started somewhere around. It's a tale as old as time in some ways. I think, though, where you're saying, Teresa, is much better. The story of a heartbroken girl named Brienne.
Well, that gets you right away. Yeah, Who is she? What's,
right.
You know.
Mm-hmm. And when you said there's even a silent watcher, well, and if you haven't guessed it, that's me. At this point, I didn't know there was a silent watcher. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that wasn't really something that I wanted to. Mm-hmm. All in all, I think the writing on this piece was very good, but I think a lot of it was kind of fluff, and you were trying to get into it, and you'd probably get on a plane all night or something.
How can you tell that just from reading it?
It's a challenge because I feel a need to start with something to hold it together because you know, there's the chapter where she wakes up in the white room.
What's wrong with starting there?
Because well, somebody did suggest that actually, that I just lose that whole resuscitation scene and start there.
But then
and bring that in as flashbacks somewhere along.
Exactly. The flashbacks where appropriate, I think. Okay. But the other thing is, because I do this, I write beginnings and then I write another beginning and then I write another beginning and I think, oh, which one do I like best? Oh, I like them all. So maybe, and this is Pot Kettle and Black, but maybe you need to just write it and worry about the beginning later.
Yes. Okay.
I wrote the beginning to Lack and Gross when I was about on chapter 18. Suddenly thought, I know how it should start now, and I went back and rewrote it.
Oh, okay. So don't worry.
Because I'd started with her in court and had her walking home, and I decided then it had to be a flashback to that event.
If it's holding you back, leave it until
I think it's important to go ahead and just write all of this stuff for yourself and then take it out.
Yeah.
But I think I mentioned once that sometime when I'm having trouble starting, I write to a friend. I start, "Dear Beverly, here's what," and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then I just, you know, later, maybe it's good, but if it's not, I can remove that part. Mm-hmm. But it gets you going.
And I
think if you're worried about it and you keep going over it and over it again, then you lose something. But if you go back to it later, then you've had other ideas and you've gone on with the story.
It will make more sense to you, I think. I agreed a lot with Linda, I think. And I did think, you actually say about going around the houses, and I thought, you're going around the house.
Yes. I wrote that for the first paragraph.
I might need to go around the houses back to the point.
I did think about, you know, there's stuff in there that, yes, you might want to keep in, and it kind of personalises it, which is nice. But I thought if you actually reversed the last two sections, put the last section from It's a Tale, blah, 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 or even the part Linda said, much nearer to the beginning, and then maybe the section from It Was Never My Intent after it. Because I found, maybe it's because I'm not a sci-fi reader particularly, but there were, you know, the stuff, the transportation, the missions and various things going on there that were quite abstract and were a little bit off-putting, I think, for a...
It's the balance between giving you a little tease of something that's coming and a bit maybe being
confusing too much. Whereas that, if you put that other bit, that, oh, this is a tale about blah, 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 that's a real sort of gripper.
Because apparently you have to... I mean, I've been reading quite a lot over the holidays, so apparently you have to let people... When people open a book, they have to immediately know what kind of genre book it is.
Yes.
You have to suck the fans of sci-fi in. And repel the others, in fact.
The opening I suggested, first it's the story of a heartbroken girl, then it's the story of an ancient evil, and you think, oh, hang on, where am I? Stephanie.
No, it's okay. No, I agree completely, and that I think that's why the resuscitation thing doesn't work as an opening, because your contract with the reader then is not sci-fi.
No,
it's a very, very
It's about a broken-hearted lover and she tried to kill herself, and we've got Reg and Pam, who play no further part in the story. My argument would be they shouldn't be there in scene one. Completely. But anyway, for me, I agree with most of what other people have said. I love the descriptive bits. I have highlighted three warms in about four lines.
Okay.
But there you go. You can.
I was obviously not feeling very warm.
No. I love the memories looking over my shoulder to make sure I get that. Was brilliant. And I loved skipping between thoughts, talking about the whiskey. There's some wonderful images there. Personally, I don't like authors addressing me directly. I prefer to read a story and work it out for myself. So for me, the whole style of you're reading this and I'm telling you what it's all about doesn't do it for me. But that's a very much a personal preference.
But it isn't the author, it's the persona she's created, the watcher. Right. But I take your point.
But I wonder, would that mean that the whole story then has to be told, Brianne's story has to be told
from the point of view of the watcher? I was playing with that idea, but I'm not liking it. It would work, but I think it would, I'm not liking it in you know, the thing about you put your books, your stuff up on sites, as we were talking about, critique, you know, you get lots of different opinions, don't you? And the one thing that people didn't seem to like was me going from chapter to chapter in media res in each chapter and trying to work out what was going on and how it all hung together. Mm. But actually, when I read sci-fi, I'm perfectly capable of doing that. We do, you know, we read chapters. Yes. Before, you can read 10 chapters before you can work out what's going on, but the chapters just have to be good enough to hook you in and make you want to know.
Make you ask the question.
What that storyline is going on.
So it's about your readership as well, which we're perhaps not your typical readers, but also even in other kinds of novels now, it's quite common to start with a scene concerning one person and then go to a scene concerning another person. You don't know the connection. Right. And that can happen 4 or 5 times, even in a police procedural. We're quite used to that. That in itself.
Perhaps I don't need to dumb it down then, just crack on.
I think the advice that Linda and Teresa have given you about just keep writing, forget about the beginning, and it will let it percolate at the back of your head, and one day you'll wake up and go, I know how it should start. Right. I think that's really good advice.
I think the reason I did, you know, because it's funny, because I had to write yesterday my introduction to myself, my new writing course I'm on. Right. And then they said, tell us in one sentence what your story's about, and then tell us the first line. Mm-hmm. So I think I was trying, and I did actually say for the first line, this is a story of a heartbroken girl called
Maria. There you go. And then to let people know it's a science fiction, you could go right into, it's a story of personal growth. There are aliens and robots, et cetera, monsters and humans. And so I think that would let people know the genre by the way, within the first 3 lines. Mm. Or so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much, ladies. Good suggestions.
Great
Thank
stuff. You. Well, there's my notes for you. Everyone's Thank rustling you. Papers and passing notes over. Well, that's lovely. Thank you, Nicola. And let's hope that our critique's given you some useful ideas.
Yes,
and if any of you have anything to add, you can leave your suggestions on our Facebook group. We're always delighted to know what you think of our work. Now, Teresa, it's over to you. You've been looking at a word of the week for us.
I have. For some reason, the word monger came up a couple of times recently. My daughter, who's studying linguistics, I had a conversation with her along the lines of why is someone who sells fish a fishmonger, but someone who sells meat is not a meatmonger? And then coincidentally, I was playing Scrabble and somebody played the word mongered. And I thought, is it a verb? Can it stand alone? So I was looking at that. So yes, it does exist in a noun and a verbal form. But the verb form has apparently only been in use since 1864. And to monger is to peddle, that is to travel about with wares to sell.
But the
noun has been around a long time. It originally with the Old English mangery, I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, meaning merchant, trader or broker, from the Latin mango, dealer, trader, slave dealer even. But it's related to Mangonian, displaying of wares. From there, it gets a slightly pejorative sense of one who adorns his wares to give them an appearance of greater value. Okay. So it's titivating what you've got for sale, basically. Yeah.
Mongering.
Yes.
And you are saying M-O-N-G-E-R.
Yeah,
M-O-N-G-E-R.
M-O-N-G-E-R. But I say monger, because that's the way I am. Fishmonger. Yes, I do. So, and also, probably a loan word based on Greek manganon, means of charming or bewitching. So hold on to that thought. It's been used in combination in English since at least the 12th century, often with overtones of petty and disreputable. For example, a ballad monger would be an inferior poet from the 16th century. The fishmonger sells fish, and the ironmonger originally sold iron goods. But why is a greengrocer sometimes called a costermonger?
Because there is an apple, or there was a type of apple called a costard.
That's correct.
Well done, Pat. We are impressed.
I was waiting for the apple. In the 16th century, it referred to an itinerant apple seller, costard being a type of large apple with prominent ribs. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
I imagine it like a quince, really, in appearance. Yeah. If a monger is someone who adorns their wares to make them look better, the origins of whoremonger are obvious.
Yeah. What about scaremonger?
Uh-huh. Now, you took the words right out of my mouth. Okay. So then we get into the more figurative uses, such as warmonger and scaremonger.
Yeah.
where there isn't actually anything for sale, but we're talking about people's ideas.
And they're used as verbs as well.
Yes, to warmonger, that's true. When we add monger, it's not usually being polite. It's usually an insult, isn't it? So if we call somebody a gossip monger or a scandal monger, we're not particularly being polite about them. More obsolete mongers are wool mongers and ale mongers. Someone who slavishly followed fashions in the 1590s could be a fashion monger. And if they also enjoyed a life of ease, they would earn the name carpet monger. I quite like that, because if you think about it, in the 1590s, a carpet was a very luxurious item. Yeah. And if you lolled about on carpets all day, you were having a very decadent life.
And there were carpet banners.
Yeah, that's a later thing. Can do that for your word of the week. A merit monger in the 16th and 17th centuries was a contemptuous term for someone who held the theological view that human merit gained heavenly reward, as opposed to the elect, I think that would be. Nowadays, we have hype mongers and doom mongers. Basically, you can add monger at will. So we could have, if I wanted to make up some words, Brexit monger and podcast monger. And finally, going back to butcher, in Old English, there was flesh monger for butcher, or a flesh monger. Yeah. But we wouldn't like that, would we?
No.
In a butcher shop,
flesh monger. Well, butcher really comes from the fact that they've taken the meat and turned it into, they butchered it and turned it into pieces of meat.
Yes, it comes from the fish, doesn't it? But yeah, you're right, because butchering is actually dismembering the animal and preparing it.
Whereas a fleshmonger would probably just sell the flesh.
Yeah, okay.
Although fleshmonger works, because you're making, by butchering it, you're making it more attractive. Oh, well, that's brilliant. Yeah. I'm going to come up with lots of monger words now. I should be thinking about it.
Digital marketing mongering.
Yes.
Word mongering.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Right, well, this is the first time we've all been together since Christmas, believe it or not. It's the end of January, and it's the first time we've all been together because we all went off in different directions to visit family and friends. Linda went back to the States. Theresa, as we know from her article in The Telegraph the other week, was in Ireland. Nicola went to the south coast of England to spend the festivities with her family. Pat enjoyed time in her Greek holiday home. My family and a few other animals rented a big farmhouse in Dorset. It seems it was only Heather that stayed close to home. We've already swapped news on presents and foods, and we're not going to subject you to that. But let's talk about our writing lives. I'm going to fess up first, okay? The only thing I wrote over Christmas were lists of things to do. But I did get to read a couple of books which are on my Sundoku. That's my pile of unread books for those that haven't listened before. And that's just as well because I've already added a few more to replace them and more. So my Sundoku is getting bigger. But as I say, not a lot of writing. Nicola, what have you been up to in terms of your writing life?
Well, I've been adding to my Sundoku or whatever it is called. I've given in. I was quite strict with myself about not building up a big list of books I wanted to read, but I'm just adding them now to my Kindle list and thinking, I've surrendered to the fact there is a wealth of fiction out there I want to read. No time to write anything at all, really. I was helping Phoebe get a new business off the ground. I was helping her apply for jobs. But I have been reading a lot and I have been thinking about it a lot. And I've done one writing course and I've started another one. And I'm looking forward to getting stuck into that for the next 6 weeks.
And of course, you were getting Writing World off the ground as well.
Oh, yes. I forgot all about that.
Yeah, we talked about it last week, remember?
Yes, we did indeed. Yeah,
we interviewed you from the south coast of England.
Now, that was sort of before Christmas and in between, but then since then it's all been about reading and getting going with these writing courses. But I felt a very big surge yesterday when I wrote this work in progress. I felt a very big surge of desire to have more time to write. So I'm really going to be very scrupulous about clearing out my diary and making more time.
Good for you. And Heather, did you get any chance to write? Did you stick to your Tuesdays?
Nope.
Well, Christmas Day was a Tuesday, wasn't
it? Yes. No, I didn't sit there and write on Christmas Day. No, I had a lovely Christmas with family and I had a big birthday just before Christmas. So lots of surprises, only a few cats let out of bags. No, I didn't write at all and I've struggled to get back into it.
And I did write down, if procrastination was a sport, I'd be a gold medalist. I keep finding all sorts of other things to do other than actually sit down and write. I did print my journal, which everybody's seen.
Lovely glossy edition.
Right.
So that should have spurred me on to do something else, but I've really got to get going. But I've got a skiing holiday booked, and I'm going to spend a couple of weeks looking after my daughter after she's had surgery on her knee. But I've really got to kick myself and get, you know, sat down and write.
Right.
And I will.
Good. Good. Linda, how about you? United States of America, lots of writing fodder there, right?
Oh, yes. Lots and lots, because I was in the South with my family. And
say no more.
Material for a trilogy, never mind.
Oh, right. I didn't get a lot done while I was there, because when I'm in the United States, I spend time with my grandchildren and other important things, so I didn't write a lot. However, I read and enjoyed it very much, because it seems to me that I don't read enough, because I'm so busy with trying to keep up with podcasts and and life in general, and I'm old and slow now. So I feel like Nicola, kind of, you know. I sat down to write after I came back, and I just wanted to do more and more. And while I was writing, all these ideas were coming about how I can put this together. And I don't want to interrupt my writing to write those down, but I want to do it more, and I need to honor that.
Okay, thanks. Pat, the distractions of Greece, did they keep you away from the keyboard?
Well, yes and no. I mean, like everybody, I did lots of reading. I actually did sort of sit in front of the laptop for a while and did a lot of sorting out of materials. We've covered lots of material over the last year. We referred to the sort of computer as like a skip. And I think mine was a bit like that. So I did some sorting out, and that was quite interesting. You know, useful reminders about areas that we've covered.
Do you ever find stories you forgot you'd written?
No.
I've done that. Yeah, not on my computer.
Yeah. I tend to write longhand and then type it up. And I discovered, and Nicola will probably laugh at me for this because it's probably like 10 years behind everybody else, I recently discovered Pinterest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And
even Linda laughed at that.
Oh, I discovered that 2 weeks ago.
And there is just tons and tons of stuff on it. You know, yes, writing on there. And I thought, not actually looking at it in detail, but just being sort of amazed by the wealth of stuff that's out there. So it did kind of fire me up a little bit, and I've been playing around with a few ideas. I think my next few WIPs, work in progress pieces, might be a bit of a hotchpotch until I actually fix on something, but I've got various ideas buzzing away. But you see, I got an Amazon voucher as well, so here I come.
Yeah, that's always good. Now, Teresa, we talked last week about your success in the Daily Telegraph Just Back Travel competition, so you obviously got some time to write while you were away.
Yeah, well, I had a very relaxing Christmas. This is my daughter and I, and I wasn't allowed to cook, so I had time to read and drink mulled wine and mince pies and lovely Butler's Irish chocolate and things like that. And also, yeah, Molly tends to disappear for a couple of hours to her study to do her Open University stuff as well. So it was very relaxed. I didn't do a lot of writing, but I have some ideas for other travel pieces, which I'm thinking about. But mainly at the moment, I'm very focused on Ranella, my dystopian children's novel. And I'm about 4 chapters in. But the more I get into it, the more complicated the plot gets. So I do need to go back and put things in that are necessary for the future plot. But I'm enjoying that. As you know, I'm not massively prolific. If I do 500 words in a week, I'm more than happy. But, you know, that's me. But I'm into that. So other things have been sort of shelved apart from the non-fiction writing, which I find quite easy, really. I know I shouldn't say that, but it's because you don't have to make it up.
Yes. That kind of leads us quite nicely into what we were going to talk about this week, because we're going to talk about competitions. And Teresa, in the last year, you've won £500.
Yeah.
From two competitions with the Telegraph Travel, Just Back, mm-hmm. weekly travel competition, and you were longlisted for a children's novel competition.
Right.
Now, I know you go all coy and modest and say, you know, or I don't do anything in particular, but you must be doing something right. So tell us what your secret is.
I wish I knew. Well, the children's book competition, one of the things that I liked about that was a very specific, very tight brief.
Mm.
Now, what I find, if you enter, you know, for the Bridport Prize, for example, there are going to be tens of thousands of entries, and it's just write a short story. You know, so it could be on any theme. And you're going to be, unless you've got a really strong idea, and I have entered it before I knew how to write anything, you're going to be in competition with a lot of published authors of literary fiction. You know, I've also entered the Dragonfly Tea competition several times. And again, thousands and thousands of people enter that. And you don't really know what they're looking for, even though I read every year the winning, if they send you a little booklet. So I think the tight brief worked for me for that particular competition.
Teresa, tell me what you mean by a brief. Are you talking about instructions for the competition?
Well, I wasn't talking specifically about the instruction for the competition in that. What I mean was the children's novel competition specifically said they wanted 2,000 words suitable for a 10-year-old reader with a 12-year-old protagonist who had to have a sidekick. There had to be two separate pieces of dialogue in it. And it specifically could not be realist. It had to be magical, dystopian, futuristic. And for some reason, that grabbed me.
Right.
But it was very clear what they wanted.
Prescriptive.
Prescriptive. But when you talk about the instructions for a competition, there again, I mean, it seems obvious, but read it, you know. And if they say they want a 12-point font in Times New Roman, don't put it in Courier 10.
Yeah, right.
If they want it anonymized, don't put your name all over it. If they want it in the body of the email, as they do for the Telegraph, put it in the body of the email.
Mm-hmm.
So those things, as I say, it's kind of obvious, but you'd be surprised if it's a 2,000-word story and you send in 3,000 words. If they get thousands of entries, they're going to weed them out that way. So, and the RAC competition, which was a few years ago.
Which you won.
Where they wanted a 1,000-word story on the theme of driving in Europe, but they specifically said no anecdotes.
Uh-huh.
Now, the story that got the third prize, so it was fiction, not an anecdote, was absolutely an anecdote. So that says they didn't get a lot of entries that fit the criteria.
Yeah, yeah.
So some of the competitions I've entered, this is not false modesty, I'm fairly sure they didn't have a lot of entrance because they weren't well publicised.
Mm-hmm. So the Daily Telegraph doesn't get a lot of entries. Just
maybe not Christmas. It's always been January, so maybe around Christmas it's a bit
slack. Right, we're all going to enter it next Christmas.
Next Christmas.
See if we can knock you off your perch.
But the last winner you put in was at Christmas time, wasn't it? Right, New Year's.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was exactly the same time of year as
the holidays.
Yes. Maybe that was it. It was just a skeleton staff in the office and not many entries came.
Oh, thank God, there's something about New Year.
The other thing that I wanted to say was sometimes you hear about a competition and it's closing next week.
Oh, yes.
So I think, I wouldn't mind having a go, but I haven't got time. So store that away and remind yourself a couple of months before or 3 or 4 months before when it's coming up next time, or look on the internet. There are lots of people who list competitions and try and look ahead of a few months. Because I often find that. I found that with the Mogford Food and Drink Prize.
Yes.
Which
I missed the deadline on that one.
Yeah. But it's worth thinking about for next year, although that is really quite a steep price, £10 to enter, but the prize is £10,000.
Oh.
But and the entries
is a bit more than your £500, isn't
it? Yes, absolutely. And the entries were open this year from November the 5th to January the 7th. So it gives you time to think about it for next year. I personally would only enter if I felt I had a really strong story, but I've got lots of time and lots of time for you guys to critique it. So who knows, I might have a go next year. But look ahead and try and find dates in the future.
Well, that's really useful. And I suppose entering the damn thing in the first place is the first step.
Got to be in it to win it.
Yeah. And if you aren't following rules about font spacing, word count, submission process, you won't even get in the running. So that's really simple rules we can implement. Right. So, Teresa, we're all very proud of you. We're a bit envious as well.
Yeah.
I mean, who wouldn't like 250 quid to kick the year off? But we're also quite well connected here on Write Club's podcast. And Teresa and I went off and spoke to Morgan Bailey, Morgan with an E, who, among her many other writerly credentials, has judged several writing competitions. Ooh. So we were able to ask her to give us some secrets from the other side of the table. So let's listen to that interview now.
We're delighted to welcome Morgan Bailey, author of several novels, including The Serial Data Shopping List, editor, online tutor, and competition judge. Welcome to Write Club, the podcast, Morgan. Thanks for talking to us.
Hello. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Morgan, tell us a little bit about how you became a writer.
It's a very long story, but to cut a short story long, or a long story short, I've moved counties, so I didn't know anybody. So I went and did evening classes. And I started off improving my French and German and my computer skills, and then looked through the prospectus. This was January 2005, and there was creative writing. And I'd enjoyed it at school, and English was my best subject. So I went along, and I was literally hooked. And back in the 80s, career advice was very limited. If you were male, you went into computing or engineering. If you were a female, it was either some kind of domestic science or to be a secretary. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I went to secretarial college, which actually has done me very well, because I wrote the first draft of the serial data shopping list, which was 115,000 words, in 28 days.
Wow.
Because I type really quickly and the ideas do gush. And I'm also very well organised. Stephanie was gasping. And
we are massively impressed.
Oh, thank you. Well, it then whittled down to 101. It then took me a year to edit on and off. And so it got down to 101,000. And I've just submitted the follow-up, which was 111,000. And I did that in 43 days on and off. But I already had the characters, so that was a lot easier. It's just a different main character with this one. So I came up here, didn't know anybody, so I went to evening classes, and it was literally light bulb moment. And I'd go to the college in the evening, come home full of ideas, and I'd go to sleep, put the light off, ping, idea, switch the light on. It was like sending Morse code messages out. Now I dictate things on my iPhone if I think of something. But it was literally like a whole world had opened. So I then spent the next few years, I joined three writing groups. I set up my own when the college course finished. I just carried on at home. And it was literally, my life changed from going to this one evening class. And that was 2005. I then went to everything. I said, you know, I'd go to the opening of an envelope if it had writing on it. And I went to literary festivals. I literally went to everything. So that was it. And I was just hooked, and I'm still hooked, and it's my favourite topic. And so I don't know how long your podcast is, but I could literally talk for the rest of the day about aspects of writing. So I'm glad you've kind of concertinaed it down to competitions.
What was the first competition you judged, and how did that come about?
Well, one of the writing groups I belong to, I'm not a member at the moment because I'm concentrating on my writing, but I'm still in contact with them, is the Northampton Writers Group, which is purely a critique group. They do have one session a year. They meet twice a month. They do have one session a year where you sit and write, and then we read it out. But normally you take up to a couple of thousand words of your own writing. And this is really how I also got into editing, because we'd sit there and give feedback. And I went to a very good school, and I think I had a good education, so my grammar's very good. And you know, when you're writing yourself, I've got beta readers going through the follow-up, and they're picking up all sorts of things. I think, well, I should have spotted that, but we're always too close to our writing. So it's a critique group, and they run the H.E. Bates short story competition, and that's been judged, and the prize giving is coming up next month. And so the way that works, which is how a lot of competitions work, especially if they're run by writing groups, is that they get all the submissions in. There's usually one or two people who collate the ball, and it's Nick Hamlin in this case. And he gets all the entries in, checks that they're within the word limit, and that's one of the things that people need to be aware of, is that usually there's a limit. And it's amazing how many people, they kind of think, well, it doesn't really matter. But when it comes in on Word, Word has a word count. So we know, even if you've gone to 2001 words, that's it. Your story doesn't get read. You've paid your money, but it won't get read. So I was a first round judge for that. And then it just kind of went snowballed from that.
When you say 2001 words, then that's it. There's no margin for error.
No, I run, and I think January is the 41st month, where I run a 100-word story, and I have a different theme for each story, each month. And it's this one is their own business. And it's interesting how people interpret that, because it could literally be a company or somebody not minding their own business, or you know, however it comes to them. But my competition, I'm quite mean, is 100 words exactly. And they've only, out of 41 months, well, I've judged 40 of them, there have literally probably only been 2 months where at least one story hasn't been disqualified. Usually because there are two words that should be hyphenated, like a well-known celebrity, well-known should be hyphenated because it's before a noun. Whereas if you say somebody is well-known, it's not hyphenated. And to be fair to everybody, if it should be hyphenated, then it counts as one word. So it goes then down to 99 words. So, and I have to be fair. I have to judge every story equally. I can't think, okay, it's, you know, it's an easy mistake to make. So that story gets disqualified. And sometimes if it comes in and it's above or below the word count, and I do give guidelines on the website, things like, you know, if it's hyphenated or ellipses don't count, or if you've got a dash or something like that, then I have to be fair to everybody and kick it out. But some do come in blatantly under, I mean, 95 or 93, I think, is the lowest I've ever had. So yes, word count. If I think 2,000 words is quite generous. But and I also judge another, there's a monthly competition run by a library festival down near Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire, and the maximum for that is 500, and it's quite surprising how many entries come in at 499 or 500, and it only takes one error for it then to go over the 500 and your story is disqualified. When that, my competition is free, but the other competition, they pay £2. And if they want me to give feedback on it, they pay an extra £5. But I would recommend not going anywhere near the top limit, you know, no more really than 490, just in case you've done something wrong.
Are there any other classic mistakes competition entrants make?
Generally, it's not sticking to the theme. I was head judge for the H.E. Bates. And the 1 year, normally it's an open theme. The thing about having a theme is that if you have a theme, everybody writes to the same topic. So it's interesting how people interpret that particular theme. But the only year that the H.E. Bates has had a theme, it was A Walk at Midnight. And you could tell that some people had already written this story and they sent their characters out at midnight to go for a walk for no particular reason, so that they stuck to that theme. And so you read this story and it might be a lovely story, but it still has to stick to the theme with my competition. So I'll have one or two winners, second, third, highly commended and honourable mentions. So all the honourable mention, they just get it on their CV. Whereas all the others, they either win free critique or I do have some online courses. So then they can take their pick of the online courses. But it's a good incentive and I don't charge for mine. And with the Beacon Lit, there are prizes monthly, and I pick three for that one. And if there are five stories that I love, I mean, that one's easier because I don't have to place them first, second, third, and so on. It's just picking my top three. So say I've got five, and they're all fabulous, but three are closer to the theme than the others, then it's quite an easy choice to make. So really, you want to get the theme. It's like writing for magazine stories. You don't kind of have a story that's not actually a women's magazine story, but you tweak it so it becomes one. Then it's less likely to be picked because they're still selecting. If they've only got space for three stories a fortnight, but they get 100 stories in, then they're going to pick their favourites. And for me, it's how I feel at the end of a story. So it's, if you write it and I go, oh, wow, then it's likely to become first or second. If you write a story and I get to the end and I go, huh, I'll read it again. And if I go, oh, yes, and it's clever, but it's so clever that I didn't get it the first time, then it will probably still go through to potentially, you know, somewhere in the pecking order. If I've read it a second time and I go, huh, you know, always get somebody else to read your story, because we know what we mean by something. If I've put something and I leave something out for the reader's imagination, the chances are the reader won't get it because I've left it out, but I haven't given enough. There's a fine line between telling everything and showing enough. I mean, show and tell, you've literally got Andy is angry, you're telling us how he's feeling. If you have him say get out or slam his fist on the desk, you're showing us that he's angry. And really, it's all about the characters. You know, the old classic page turning, we want to know that the person's going to be all right. They have a conflict at the beginning. You have your dead body in the crime novel. We want to find out, because we then find out who this person is, and we get to like them even though we never meet them. And then by the end of it, they've got their justice. It's the same in any story. You get to read a 2,000-word story for the H.E. Bates, and it's quite a chunk of time that it doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're judging, we had batches of 25, and we might read 50, 75 stories as the first round judges. And then the head judge, which I was one year for the H.E. Bates, you have 10 stories and you then pick your favourite three. And you're investing that time. And if you get, and you will read, unless the story is so bad, I will read the whole story. And you want to know, it's all about what happens at the end. You know, you've put this character up a tree, someone else is throwing rocks at them, and you want to know that they're going to get down unhurt. They might have cuts and bruises, but then they, you know, the baddie gets their comeuppance. So it's, for me as a judge, it's how they feel at the end of, how I feel about the story at the end.
Apart from the obvious benefits of winning prizes or money, are there other benefits or gains for a writer in entering a competition?
Well, I don't always hear from the people who I've emailed back saying you've come first. Even the winners, I don't always hear, even though they've won critique or the choice of online courses. Some people bank them, so if they're regular entrants, and they might win 2,000 word free edit. I've got one lady who entered a 17,000 word story for a competition, and she banked, she'd done really well, and she banked all these wins with the honourable mention, you've done well, but not quite well enough to win a prize. And even that, there was a lady the other day, and she'd entered so many competitions and hadn't got anywhere, and she'd entered my competition. First time, she's got an honourable mention, and I get probably 40, 50 entries a month, and she's got an honourable mention, and she said she was so thrilled, beautiful email, sent me this lovely email, so thrilled, she was on the verge of giving up, and it's given her the boost. Plus also, if you're sending something off, even if you're sending off a novel, if you've won or say been shortlisted on the Bridport, which is one of the competitions, if you're even longlisted on the Bridport, it shows that someone else, that a peer, thinks that your writing is worthy, that you're good at what you do, and it gives you the boost. So it's twofold, really. Even if you don't win any money, it keeps you motivated. Because the main thing with competitions is that they have to be unpublished. So I would recommend being very careful, sending off stories where you're not going to get a chance of at least getting some money back for it. Because especially if you've spent a week writing a 2,000-word story and then get it published on a blog, you can't use it then to submit it for a competition. Even if that person's deleted it, Google will still have it. and the likes, it'll still be out in the ether. So be very careful what you publish where and what you send where, because writing is one of the few industries where you are often asked to do things for nothing. So people want content. And I get a lot of online writers who want me to publish their articles just so that they get the website URL. I only publish authors who want to promote their books. And so it's a fabulous industry for supporting. You know, podcasts are brilliant. And people who listen to this and might get motivated to write a story, or they might hear something that think, oh yes, that would make a good story. And the online community is just fabulous. I mean, you'll know from your Facebook group how supportive all the writers are.
Yes, we were talking only recently about the generosity of successful writers in helping aspiring authors. For example, someone said they'd seen Val McDermott at an event and she'd been extremely giving of her time.
Absolutely. I've met her a few times, especially at Harrogate Crime Festival. And the only time I've not seen her in a T-shirt and shorts is when she was interviewing J.K. Rowling as Robert Galbraith. And then she wore a shirt and longer shorts, so they weren't quite trousers. And J.K. Rowling was there in a suit because she was, that's her kind of her male, you know, her alter ego. But Val is lovely, and she does the New Blood panels. So that's purely for people who've just done well with their debut novels. And that's just, you know, fabulous exposure. And really, it's all about exposure. You know, when we get guests on other people's websites or podcasts here, it's getting our name out there. And when you enter a competition and your name appears on a website, you do a screen print or tell the world, and it's all, you know, it's, you just need that lucky break.
So do you have any other particular tips for catching the judge's eye?
Titles. Even as a head, well, especially as a head judge, you don't know who the entrants are. So only the people organising the competition will know who they are, because you're judging the story on the merit, not on who wrote it. And when I got all these, this batch of 25 stories, there was one called The Bus Driver Who Stopped and Then Didn't. And when I'm going through stories, it's not so much with 100 word, because I tend to read them and place them as they come in. But with these 25 stories, they're all numbered, so I could put them back in their order. But I go for the least interesting title first. And usually that's often not necessarily at least interesting story. But The Bus Driver Who Stopped and Then Didn't, I left that till last. And when I'm reading a collection of short stories, I'll quite often go to the ones that I like the most, leave those till last. And it turned out to be my favourite story. And you have, with this round of judges, as often happens if you have a series of judges, you score each story. It goes back to the organiser, and then the top ones will then go off to the head judge. Then later I found out who had written the story. And coincidentally, he won the competition the following year. But it was just such a fabulous story. Really, it's like a book title. It's no different from the book title, except you don't have the cover picture to grab your reader. So I had a story called The Journey that I sent to Women's Weekly. And generally, the something, unless it's The Great Gatsby that everybody knows, you want to pick something out. And I find when I'm writing stories, often there'll be a phrase in there that leaps out. And that was a story about a woman whose husband had died. And it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. He was a guzzler. And he died of a heart attack because he'd just eat anything she gave him. And she's left, and he would only go on holiday in England, and he would drive, and so that was their holidays. And now she's a sort of newly found freedom. Starts off where she's sitting in a plane, and then we find out this story. And there's a phrase where she's sent all these postcards from all the relatives and friends that have gone overseas, and she sees all these beautiful places that she wants to visit, but her husband won't because they only have driving holidays in England. And there's a line where there are so many postcards that there's on the fridge that there's no white left. And that I then changed it from the journey to no white left. And I often find that there's a website called Story A Day. And every May, there's a lady in America called Julie who puts a prompt up and you write a story every day for May. And I did that 2011, 2012, 2013. And I carried on going 2013. And so for a year, I wrote a different story. I came up with it my own prompt, but I wrote a story a day for a whole year. And I often found that there would be, I'd write something, oh, that would make a perfect title. So that's a very long answer to your question of titles. So making a snappy title. And where you've got a theme, if you've got somebody who writes, say, about a business that's failing, and it's a fairly generic story, if you've got something where you have something out of the ordinary. A few years ago, I went on a weekend course, and the lady said there, this was for writing women's magazine stories, and she said, once you get your idea, write down 12 different scenarios for that idea and pick the 13th. Because everybody else will think of those 12 stories. You then want to pick the idea that nobody else picks. So don't necessarily go with the story that you think that comes to you straight away.
So if our listeners want to enter your competitions, how should they find you?
I'm very easy. I mean, you can Google Morgan with an E, but my basic website is Morgan, so it's M-O-R-G-E-N, and then Bailey, BAILEY.com, and that forwards itself to morganbailey.wordpress.com, and everything's on there. You can see there's me on the front page, there's a click to the blog, and so on and so forth. So at the moment, I'm judging three competitions. I've got my monthly 100 word and the Beacon Lit, which is 500 words every month. And I'm also the judge for the yearly Flash 500, which is 2,000 words. It's flash500.com.
We'll put the link to that on our Facebook group. That's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you very much, Morgan.
You're very welcome. Thank you for asking.
Crikey, lots to think about there. Mm, has that encouraged anyone to give competitions a go this year?
I think I will. I haven't done a competition for years and years. I don't think I've done one since graduate school. So I'm going to find one that is very prescriptive, as Teresa said, so I know exactly what to do. And I think I want to do it just because I need to do that sort of thing to hone my skills more.
Yeah, it gives you a focus.
Yeah, right. It is. It's that focus. And I think Teresa's advice about actually thinking ahead, because I've loads of times, as somebody will put things on the podcast page and so on, and I think, oh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
And I think, oh, next week or even next month. Yeah. Forget it. Yeah. You really do need to kind of keep a diary and
maybe make a portfolio of stuff. Yeah. Like you said, you've been sorting out all your old work. I mean, I know, Teresa, you won another competition where it was for a play, wasn't it?
Yes.
And you'd already written the play and it was in a folder and you'd...
It fitted the brief, actually, which was no more than four actors, 45 minutes to an hour long, a comedy with very simple staging.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And Teresa already had that in her bottom right-hand drawer, so she pulled it out, closed it up, whacked it in, and won £100.
Is it £100? I can't remember. I think it was something like that.
Yeah. So there you go. Not that she's got any secrets. No. Well, well done, Teresa. And I think I'm going to give a couple of competitions go this year. Mm-hmm. And I know Heather, having been highly commended in the last, or the first and last competition that you entered, you're going to do some more, aren't you?
Yes. Brilliant.
Good for you.
So which ones are you going for?
I want to enter the next Lit Fest competition.
Oh, yeah. Good.
I get critiqued by my colleagues.
Because I've been doing quite a lot of research on the backgrounds of sci-fi writers, so I'm going to look up some sci-fi, because a lot of sci-fi writers, before they get published, get noticed in competitions. Mm-hmm. So that sounds like a good way to do
that. Yeah.
I never looked for something that blunt humor. Mm-hmm. And I think I'll probably have to go to the United States competitions because my stories are set in the United States and some of the settings and accents and et cetera probably would not be well understood by
I wouldn't assume that. We all love your work. But can I say, really? It's humorous, but it's not comedy.
No, it's not. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you could even American Abroad kind of thing. You know, we all love Bill Bryson, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Mm. He travels around looking at things from a wide eye, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, okay. That's what I'll do. Mm-hmm. And I'll find one that the deadline is in July.
Yeah. See, I'm the exact opposite. I'm more likely to enter something if the deadline's soon rather than longer because I just... unless I get some momentum going, I'm not going to do anything else. You have to know yourself, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. I've got nothing specific in mind. Mm-hmm. I shall have a little look at the list.
Yes, I'm going to go back to Writing Magazine and have a look at the calendar for the year. Well, it's almost time to end this episode of Write Club, the podcast. But before we go, let's ask Eve White, that lovely literary agent that we spoke to earlier this month. Eve White, what's on your bedside table?
I've just started The North Water by Ian McGuire, which opens in a really, it's historical fiction, and it's, I've had it recommended to me. I've heard it's brilliant, and it starts absolutely brilliantly. It's very, very dark, about a chap who's going off on a ship, but before he leaves, he's in dirty old Victorian London getting up to absolutely vile things. I don't know how I'm going to love this character because of what he's done so far. But anyway, that is a brilliant opening.
Well, that sounds really interesting. And actually, that book was longlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2016 and shortlisted for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize as well. So I think that will be a good one. Okay, and finally then, Linda, what's on your bedside table?
Mm. Well, first, I just wanted to point out that Eve White Sendoko is at least 2 years high because that was in 16. And she's reading it now. Well, on my bedside table, I'm enjoying a novel that's called Beautiful Animals. It was chosen by a member of the book club I belong to. And it's set on the Greek island of Hydra. Is it Hydra? Hydra?
Hydra.
Hydra.
Hydra. It depends what language you speak. Hydra.
Okay, Hydra. It's a small island where no cars are allowed, only donkeys and motorbikes. The main characters are two beautiful, bored young women spending the summer with their families, one family being very well off and the other being incredibly wealthy. They become friends, and not far into the book, they discover a migrant washed up on the far side of the island, and that discovery changes everything for them and many others in the book. It's a beautiful setting, beautiful characters, and it quickly turns beautifully menacing.
Ooh,
I'm quite hooked on it.
Sounds really good.
And who's that by, Linda?
It's by Lawrence Osborne. He's a British-born writer living in Bangkok. He also wrote The Foreigner, The Forgiven, and The Ballad of a Small Player and others. But I highly recommend it if you want an absorbing read.
And I highly recommend going to Hydra. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It is.
Where Leonard Cohen used to be.
Yeah, he's mentioned in this book. And I was thinking maybe after reading it, I thought maybe I'll go there just like for a writer's retreat.
Maybe we should all go for a writer's retreat.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about
we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about retreats in next week's show. So hold that thought, ladies.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, we'd love to know what's on your bedside table too. So if you'd like to share that with us, then just record a short 2-minute piece giving us the title and the author and why you chose the book and what it's about. But no spoilers, please. You can email it to us at contributions@writeclubthepodcast.com. We'll post details of how to do that on our Facebook group. As I said, in next week's show, we're going to be talking about writing retreats, ways to get away from the hubbub and just write. So we hope you'll join us for that. In the meantime, please invite your writerly friends to join us by sharing a link to this podcast with them. And remember to tell them about the Facebook group too. The more the merrier. And finally, it would really help us if you would leave us a 5-star review with your podcast provider. That will encourage even more writers to join us. So until next week, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.